Thank you. Thank you, Seth. And thanks everyone for coming and for the invitation to speak here to talk about some recent experiments at Rice with Rydberg systems. So this experiments with the Rydberg atom synthetic dimensions are a collaboration experimentally with Barry Dunning, and also on the theory side, Caden Hazard, with the lead graduate student, Somya, and a team supporting him as well. So I'll start off explaining what the Rydberg atom synthetic dimensions are and our first demonstration using them to realize the SSH Hamiltonian, and a little bit about what we can hope to be able to do with them. I think I'll have a little bit of time at the end also to just give an update on our experiments with ultra-long Rydberg molecules, which this group I think has heard about and is we'll hear about more during this session as well. So a synthetic dimension is some internal degree of freedom in a quantum system that can be engineered to mimic or to be an analog of the motion of a particle in a physical space, often in a lattice system. And so these synthetic dimensions have attracted a lot of attention for quantum simulation because of the flexibility you have, control over all the terms in the Hamiltonian, excellent dynamics, and the ability to realize quantum systems that may be very, very complex or maybe even impossible to realize in real physical space. And there are lots of different realizations of this. Very common ones are sort of the hyperfine states or magnetic Zeeman sublevels, the internal states in an atom, which can be coupled together to form a synthetic dimension. And often that can be grafted onto the motion of particles in a real space lattice to create things like ribbons. Also, there have been really nice results using the different momentum states of atoms in a Bose-Einstein condensate coupled by momentum kicking Raman transitions to form a lattice of discrete states. Also realizations in photons and many other even mechanical systems. One system that has been proposed but not realized experimentally is to use the rotational states of molecules as a synthetic dimension. This was proposed by Caden Hazard and Bryce Gadway. And that's actually the inspiration for what we have done at Rice, which is to use the internal states, the Rydberg states of an atom as the basis for a synthetic dimension. So I'll explain a little bit about how that works here. So in this situation, I've shown a ladder of Rydberg states, some S states and P states. When a Rydberg atom in a given site or state, internal state here, corresponds to a particle occupying one site of the lattice. So each state corresponds to one site of the lattice. And the tunneling between the lattice sites is induced in the synthetic space by microwave frequencies applied that are near resonant or on resonant with these various transitions. So the configuration of the synthetic space is completely controllable by the configuration of the couplings or the frequencies of these microwave transitions, which can get quite complicated if you want to. If you have on resonant microwave transitions, then all the different states in your or the levels in your synthetic lattice are degenerate. But if you detune your millimeter waves from the resonance frequencies, then you can apply different on-site chemical potentials. So that gives you a sense of some of the flexibility that you can have. So there are some nice advantages of the Rydberg atoms for synthetic dimensions. In principle, there are many, many states here. You have all the almost infinite number of Rydberg atoms, Rydberg atomic states. And the lifetimes can be quite long, at least long compared to the coupling frequencies that you could apply because of the strong matrix elements between the Rydberg states. So it's with typical millimeter wave technologies, you can apply 1 to 10 megahertz Rabi frequencies for the couplings, and the typical spacings between the energy levels are between 1 and 100 gigahertz, which gives you a nice separation of energy scales. And what's also very nice is the very advanced components in the microwave technologies that are available commercially in order to apply multiple frequencies to connect these various levels. And I'll also mention that in the synthetic space, I'll describe the detection that can give us, in principle, sort of single site resolution. So, you know, what kind of things could you imagine? I drew a picture of sort of one-dimensional synthetic space or lattice, but you could imagine coupling higher dimensions if you add in two photon transitions to, you know, here's a breathing Kagame lattice, for example. You could imagine topologies that are not easily accessible in real space. Here, by having a ladder which is then coupled, you could do a loop. And if you were to, you know, cross the connections on the loop, you could imagine making a Mobius strip, for example. And then you could easily imagine, you know, time-dependent drives and controlling the phases of the drives for creating synthetic fields, applying different strengths of the connectivity or the chemical potentials. You could put in disorder. You can couple to lossy states for dissipation. You could also imagine having interactions if you can somehow get multiple particles, and I'll say a bit in a moment how we would do that. Say you have two particles nearby each other in real space, you have the flip-flop interaction. If you have an S state or P state and an S state, that changing to a P to an S state, that's a very strong interaction. And it's actually a localized interaction in the synthetic space because that matrix element is very strongly peaked when the particles occupy very, very closely spaced principal quantum numbers, but where if they move far apart in quantum numbers, the matrix element falls off very rapidly. So it's actually a localized interaction in synthetic space. So to realize interacting systems, you would imagine arrays of optical tweezers. So this could easily be grafted onto the kind of experiments which many people are doing now. And this would hold the atoms in real space at well-defined separations. And then in the internal space, they'd all be moving in the same synthetic space here. So this is how you could imagine making interacting systems. And so, and what our first example we've looked at is something with a topological band structure, and that is this one-dimensional SSH Hamiltonian. So this is proposed as a sort of a prototypical model for motion of electron through a polyacetylene molecule. It's a one-dimensional lattice with a number n unit cells. Each cell consists of two states, so there are two n sites, and you can think of sort of an A group of sites and a B group of sites. Here it would be the S versus the P. And typically you have alternating strong and weak tunneling through this lattice. And for the classic SSH Hamiltonian, there'd be no on-site potential. And this is the simplest model, so it's very common. We already have heard about it today, for a system that shows some sort of topological behavior. And in this case, it has topologically protected edge states. And this comes from an underlying chiral symmetry in which all the Hamiltonian terms are between the sublattices, nothing that's restricted to just one sublattice. And we demonstrated this Hamiltonian with synthetic dimensions in a recent publication. So at this level, the system is easy to write down the Hamiltonian for it, and here in this configuration of the strong and weak tunneling, and you can find the eigenstates and calculate all the things that you might want to know about it, which is a nice way for us to test whether our synthetic dimensions really, really work. So here is the band structure that you would get, so the energy levels that come out of this Hamiltonian as a function of the ratio of the strong to weak coupling, and here the energies are normalized by the weak coupling as well. And here is the decomposition of the eigenstates in terms of the initial sites, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And so one of the signatures of the topological nature of this system is edge states with an energy at E equals 0, and they're called edge states because the probability is localized on the edge states of your one-dimensional lattice. And the energy of these states and their localization is robust to any perturbation that preserves this chiral symmetry, that doesn't add any Hamiltonian terms that connect that are between sites of the same lattice. And this is one of the signatures of the SSH model in the topological configuration, which is weak connections to the edge sites. If you have strong connections to the edge site, then there are no edge sites, and there are no states at E equals 0. So these are the signatures that we'll look for to show that we have actually simulated this Hamiltonian. So the experimental details are that we trap a sample of the bosonic isotope, one of the bosonic isotopes of strontium, in an optical dipole trap. We do this in a bulk sample, so not in a tweezer. So that means we work hard to just excite zero or one Rydberg atom at a time with pulsed excitation, so we don't get any Rydberg excitation. So we're just looking at single particle dynamics in this lattice. And we're exciting up to the triplet S Rydberg state through a two-photon excitation. The microwaves are applied during this excitation time, and we apply a four Gauss field, which lifts the degeneracy that you might worry about with a triplet S1 state. So we really go from one triplet S1 state to the unique triplet P0 state, and those are the states that form our lattice. And the Rabi couplings we explore, which are twice the tunneling elements, are up to 4 megahertz, or easily accessible. Our detection for a Rydberg excitation is selective field ionization. So we have a pulsed excitation. We'll typically turn off the dipole trap for that. And then very shortly after that, really within a microsecond or two, we'll ramp up an electric field which rips off the electron. And what's nice about this is that the arrival time of the electron will tell us what Rydberg quantum number the Rydberg atom was in, or what site of the synthetic lattice was occupied. So the selective field ionization is a really nice probe with essentially single site resolution in the lattice. So that's how we detect the excitation, but how do we probe the band structure? How do we probe the Hamiltonian? Well, we do that by essentially injecting the system into this coupled manifold with our two-photon excitation from the ground state into some state in this synthetic lattice. So these couplings are relatively strong, and this is a weak excitation into this manifold. So how does this work? Well, if we have our laser tuned near one of the unperturbed states, then our detuning delta around that unperturbed state, that actually gives the energy in the synthetic space or energy in the band structure that's being probed. So the detuning around this 58S state, for example, is the energy in the band structure that we're probing in synthetic space. And then the amplitude of the signal at whatever detuning we are, well, so this is going to be one of the states in the synthetic lattice. The amplitude of this signal gives us the overlap of the state in synthetic space with the bare atomic state that we're tuned next to. So from the intensities, we essentially get this decomposition of the states onto the bare Rydberg atoms or the bare lattice sites. So in this case, if we tune near the triplet S1, which is the labeled state number 3, you can see that there should be very little occupation in the E equals 0 edge state and a lot of these bulk states that are shifted away. And that's what we see here, big intensity on the bulk states and only very small intensity on that edge state. If I detune near another bulk state, it gives a very similar pattern. If you look very closely, even less of the edge state excitation, and that's matched here as well. But if I detune to where the edge state should be, I look at the overlap with the bare edge state, you can see all your excitation probability is showing up here, and that's because there's a big overlap here at those edge states. So if I put it all together, it's a little bit clearer to see, at least the band structure. So here, combining all the different spectra tuned near the same, near the different bare states, they all give the same band structure picture. So from each of these detunings, we can map out that band structure as a function of the ratio of strong to weak tunneling. As you increase the ratio, you get a bigger splitting of the bulk states compared to the edge states. And it matches the theory quite well. And then these patterns of intensities, as I mentioned, they give you the overlap with the bare states, or the localization of the edge states, for example, is the easiest thing to see. If we tune our laser to the I equals 1 state, that's where all the intensity is on the edge state. And as you tune away from that edge state, you can see the falling off in the overlap with the triplet S1 state, which was what we expect if you look into the Hamiltonian and the behavior of these states. So it matches the direct diagonalization. If I switch the ratio of the strong to weak couplings, then we don't expect to see this state at E equals 0, which is this localized state. There is no localized state here. And if I do that, you can see that no matter which state, bare state I tune next to, we don't see any excitation probability near E equals 0 because there's no state localized in that gap. So this gives us the band structure, which shows us, as well as the state decomposition, that shows us we're matching the behavior we expect for the SSHD. Now, one of the other characteristics of these edge states is that they protected by certain types of perturbations to the Hamiltonian, but not all types of perturbations. For example, if I change the tunneling amplitude, so the amplitudes here sort of add some a little bit of disorder to the system, but it still doesn't, all the Hamiltonian elements connect the sites A and the sites B, we find that the E equals zero state is not perturbed. The bulk states do shift around a bit, but the E equals zero state stays where it is, so that doesn't destroy the underlying symmetry. But if I detune the frequency of this coupling, such as this coupling here to the to one of the edge states, that adds a term of the Hamiltonian that is just between sites on one of the sublattice that breaks the underlying chiral symmetry, and then we see that the edge state moves around in energy space as we change the detuning. So now this breaks it, it's no, you know, breaks the conditions for the topological nature of the Hamiltonian. So that shows most of the characteristics that we wanted to show. I want to say a word about what the selective field ionization and how it can be useful as a, also as a way of resolving where the wave packet is in our synthetic space. So just to remind you, after we do our excitation, we apply our electric field that rips that electron off, we detect that electron, and we look at the arrival time to tell us what state that electron was in or what site of the synthetic lattice was occupied. So here is the selective field ionization signal if we park our laser onto one of the bulk states. Then we see that the arrival times of the signal all correspond to states that are in the bulk. I don't have that figure up here, but none, you know, the edge states, for example, the 57S, the arrival time would show up here. We show no population there if we have the laser tuned to the bulk state. But if I have my laser tuned to the edge state, then you see that the dominant signal shows up at the arrival time we expect if the system is localized on an edge state or localized in that that particular Rydberg site, which is on the edge of my lattice. So this essence gives us a wave probe in looking into where the system is. For the strontium quantum defects, really, I have to be honest, we have about two-site resolution. You could see there's some degeneracy here that I can't resolve, at least with our system right now. But that's still pretty good. And this opens up a lot of interesting experiments to look at wave packet dynamics, for example. So here's an example of what we could do. We could essentially have no millimeter waves on, or that's equivalent of very little tunneling between the lattice sites. And we could inject a particle to a well-defined state of the synthetic lattice, for example, here, the localized 58P, so localized somewhere in the bulk, and then we could turn on the desired Hamiltonian, and then the system, the wave packet would diffuse and tunnel around and have dynamics, and then we can freeze the wave packet by turning off the millimeter waves, and then do the selective field ionization and see where the wave packet is gone. For example, we would see that hopefully the system doesn't explore the edge state, it moves in the bulk, and vice versa, if we put the system in the edge state, it should localize there. So these are the kind of experiments that we hope to be able to do with this system. So this SFI diagnostic could be very powerful. So what are some of the challenges for this? When you actually start doing an experiment, you realize that putting all these millimeter waves on gives you lots of AC Stark shifts to keep track of for all the different levels, and you really have to map out all the AC Stark shifts for all the different millimeter waves. So it's an increasing number of AC Stark shifts to keep hold of. If you want to be able to detune your millimeter waves to a certain amount, you need to know exactly what those detunings are. So that increases, and we had to go through all the characterizations for our six-state system, and that will increase as the number of sites increases. And also, you know, your millimeter wave hardware, your microwave hardware will increase as your number of sites goes up, but you know, that's really, it's a very advanced technology. That shouldn't be so bad. What's still an open question is decoherence. As we increase the number of sites, you worry about accidental degeneracies in the Rydberg manifolds. We've also seen some sign of, as we increase the Rydberg, the millimeter wave couplings, decoherence is showing up in the system in very site-selective ways. We still need to understand that. You can see as the couplings increase, you can see one of these states getting very, very broad. Is this due to accidental degeneracies with other states, or is there something fundamental into it? That's still something we need to explore. one of the things that we've done, which I'm very excited about, is switching to excitation to the singlet Rydberg series, which will have a much lower state density. So I hope that'll also, you know, minimize these problems compared to going to the triplet levels, but that remains to be seen. So I'll have an intermediate conclusion here. I've wrapped up on the synthetic dimensions. So I've shown you that our first demonstration of the Rydberg synthetic dimension as a new platform for quantum simulation. And so far we've demonstrated single particle band structure for the SSH model and demonstrated the characteristics of topological edge states. And we have high hopes of moving into looking at dynamics of wave packets in these spaces, larger spaces, and then setting up a tweezer system to allow us to do multi-particle dynamics. With that, I think I have a few minutes left, so I would like to say a few words about our work with ultra-long-range Rydberg molecules. That work is continuing, first for measuring three-body spatial correlations, which builds off of work with Hussein Sajapour, Richard Schmidt, and others, and then ultra-long-range Rydberg molecules formed in a gas of background atoms where the interactions between the background atoms is non-negligible. I think this is important for me to give a quick introduction to what ultra-long-range Rydberg molecules are. These were predicted now almost 20 years ago by several folks we all know and love here in the audience, and were observed about 10 years ago in Tillman Pfau's group. So the interaction of the Rydberg electron with a ground state atom forms a potential for that ground state atom binding to the Rydberg core to form molecules. And that potential is proportional to the S wave scattering length between the electron and the ground state atom in the simplest approximation, and the probability density distribution of the Rydberg electron. So it forms potentials that look like shown here, and you can bind ground state atoms in that potential around the Rydberg atom. And the binding energies can be tens of megahertz, and so we can create these molecules if we start with ultra-cold temperatures. Here's a picture in strontium. This at zero detuning is the excitation of a bare Rydberg atom. And detuned to the red, you can see discrete states, which correspond to putting one ground state atom in the various vibrational states of this potential. So these are the dimers, one background atom, one Rydberg atom. But you also get trimers, which is one Rydberg atom and two background atoms put into these various vibrational states. And we can even see tetramers and petramers, very, very rich spectrum here. So to make the Rydberg molecules, it's a very similar experiment to the synthetic dimensions. We do it in a dipole trap, but here we'll make use of the fact that we have several different isotopes, two bosonic ones, 84 strontium and 86 strontium. We also have fermionic 87 strontium as well. And there's some nice advantages of strontium. We have a singlet S0 ground state perturber. We don't have any hyperfine structure. And a detail important to the experts, there's no P-wave resonance for electron atom scattering in the strontium system. So I'll first mention about using these Rydberg molecules to measure spatial correlations in the initial gas before you do the excitation. And this takes advantage of the fact that in order to form a molecule, say here where there's a very localized separation between the Rydberg core and the ground state atom, say localized in the outer well, this is typically the most deeply bound dimer state. In order to form that molecule, you need to have two atoms with the correct separation in the initial gas. So the excitation probability really is proportional to the sort of essentially the Frank-Condon overlap of the initial state with the final molecular state. So that intensity of the excitation is proportional to the probability of finding two particles in the initial gas with the correct separation. So that probability is proportional to the pair correlation function in the initial gas. And you can make that a little bit more formal by looking at the theory for it. But from an experimental point of view, I just park my laser on that dimer state where I know I'm exciting that well-localized separation of interparticle spacings, and look at the intensity of that excitation. And if I tune the different quantum numbers, I get to look at how that excitation probability is changing as a function of the interparticle spacing. The interparticle spacing in the initial gas, but it's set by the size of the Rydberg molecule that we create. So I can measure that pair correlation function at long range and at tunable distances. So we're mapping out the long-range spatial correlations. And there aren't that many different probes that can really map out the long correlations on this interesting range. So this is a very powerful probe because we can vary the separation at which we probe. And it's on an interesting length scale. Here's the size of typical molecules we can create. It's sort of in between the, you know, the very, very short range or zero range correlations that are typically measured by different loss processes, collisional processes, and the sort of 1 micron type correlations you can look at optically in a quantum gas microscope. Of course, we had a beautiful discussion of the ion microscope, which can also look at correlations over these various length scales as well. But in this regime, you have resonance scattering processes. You can be on the order of interparticle separations or inverse Fermi wave vectors. A lot of quantum states reveal their signatures in this range, and it'd be great to have an in situ probe of correlations on this regime. And we also have excellent time resolution because we can do Rydberg excitations and probing on very short time scales. So in principle, we could look at dynamics as well. So our first demonstration was looking at two-body pair correlation functions, and we mapped out for bosonic isotopes the bunching for identical bosons in the same internal state, and the Pauli exclusion principle for fermions that you'd expect as well. So a textbook example, these are both in thermal gases, importantly, this was not in a BEC, obviously. And we do this just by looking at the ratio of these various excitations. And the important thing that to note is that we have there are factors we have to normalize, various matrix elements and overlap integrals that are not the correlations that we're interested in. And we get to normalize them out with essentially a classical gas, which is our 87 strontium system, the fermion. If we don't polarize it, it has a nuclear spin of I equals 9.5 in the ground state, so 10 spin states. So if we don't polarize it, essentially looks like a classical gas for us. So using that as a background, we're able to get normalize out and just isolate the quantum statistics by looking at the ratio of the excitation strengths for the polarized fermions to the unpolarized, or the bosonic system to the unpolarized Fermi system. And that gives us this this type of curve for the pair correlation function. And this was published a year and a half ago or so in collaboration with Hossein and Richard and also the group in Vienna as well. So we've been working to improve our probe and make it work better and move on to show that we can also measure three-body spatial correlations by parking the excitation laser onto the trimer as opposed to onto the dimer state. And so this, as you might expect, it maps out the probability of finding three particles with the right separation. In this case, the right separation is two ground state atoms around a center, which that central atom eventually becomes the Rydberg atom. Now, it's important to note that our Rydberg excitation is insensitive to the angular orientation of the two ground state atoms. So the excitation probability measures an angle-averaged three-body correlation function. But that turns out to be not too big of a complication to handle, but it is important to keep in mind. And here's our results. We've, again, working with sort of our textbook demonstration of just thermal gas coherence for the bosonic system or for the fermions with non-interacting system. We can see here's the dimer data that I showed you before, the blue and the purple, and then the trimer data, so the three-body correlation function is shown here, and the striking one is for the bosonic. You can see the enhancement going up to the 3-factorial probability for finding three particles on top of each other. So it's working very, very nicely. I will give credit to the students. It's not easy to get this data. Measuring signal intensities as opposed to frequency shifts is always harder because there's so many things that you have to keep hold of for the laser intensities, the sample densities. You need to normalize for all of that to get this under control. But very promising. And so now we hope we can turn this system now to more interesting systems that have non-trivial correlations. We have an optical lattice in the system now, and our initial focus is to look at 1D systems to map out the pair and three-body correlations in the strongly interacting 1D gas regime. So look for more to come. Now, as I mentioned, that's all non-interacting systems. Okay, so this is the textbook example that you derive, neglecting the interactions between the particles. But we also have isotopes of strontium that have very strong interactions, strong enough to affect the wave function of the scattering wave function in the initial system on the length scale of the Rydberg molecule that we're going to create. So here's the potential for the Rydberg atom, here's the size, the interparticle spacing. So we have this well-localized system here. And for the 86 strontium, 800 bor is actually getting to be on the order of the Rydberg molecule we can create. So you would think that by looking at the excitation probability, we'd be sensitive to the fact that this wave function has structure here. Whereas in the 84 strontium, where all the interactions are short range, on the scale of the Rydberg molecule, you can average over many, many partial waves, and the effects of the phase shift should wash out. And we actually see significant differences in the Rydberg molecule excitation for the, or what I would say, the weakly interacting system compared to the strongly interacting system. So everything about it should be the same, except changing the interactions in the initial state. And specifically, we see a featureless excitation spectrum for the weakly interacting system, but in the strongly interacting system, we see extra features on the spectrum showing up. So clearly, these interactions are having an important effect. And if we look as a function of principal quantum number at the spacing between the different features, we find that the spacing of these features closely matches what you would expect for rotational splittings, rotational energy levels in the Rydberg molecules that we excite to. Not exact match, but very close. So we ascribe this then to actually resolving the rotational levels in the Rydberg molecules. So lots of rich questions to ask yourselves here, like, why do we only see this structure when the interactions are strong in the ground state? And our theory seems to support it's not as quantitative as we might like it, but basically the picture is that if you're suppressing the S wave scattering on the length scale of Rydberg molecule in the strongly interacting case, then by suppressing the strong S wave, it allows you to pick up the weaker partial waves, which are not suppressed due to scattering. In this case, these are D waves that give this splitting. But still, lots of interesting questions here. What are the selection rules to excite these Rydberg molecules? The energy is not quite matching. Why is that? And there are also surprising intensity patterns that I'll say a little bit about in my last minute or two here. So too much for me to go on, but lots of interesting questions that this system opens up. I'll say first about some unexpected components and relates to the selection rules. So you would sort of expect that you'd see rotational levels in the molecule if those angular momentum quantum numbers are present in the initial state. Because essentially, it's just a Frank-Kanon overlap from the initial state to the final state. So for the bosons in identical states, you would expect only even rotational quantum numbers. And that's predominantly what you see. But clearly, we see additional features which in this case match n equals 3. So we're seeing the odd partial waves. And where that actually comes from is that we cannot neglect the momentum kick, the relative momentum kick between the Rydberg atom and the ground state atom, which is normally not important on small molecules, but these molecules are so big that we can't neglect that. And then that adds coupling between different angular momentum states in the initial state and the final state. So this gives you a sense of the richness that's there. I really should wrap up, but there's other real mysteries. So that I think we understand. There are mysteries we really don't understand. For example, the intensity patterns. We have a simple theory which of looking at the Frank-Kanon overlap integrals, and some of the quantum numbers just totally don't match what you would expect for the intensity patterns. And we don't know whether that's due to some short-range physics or something else happening here. So clearly stuff we don't understand. Other thing that's really got us scratching our head is there's a strong magnetic field dependence in the spectrum and the intensity of the lines in the strongly interacting case that we don't see in the weakly interacting case. So this has really got us, we don't have a good explanation for this at the moment. So if anyone wants to talk or think about that, I'd be happy to share more on that. So with that, I will wrap up on this portion of the talk where I've told you a little bit about our ultra long range Rydberg molecule work, probing correlations, but also looking at the effects of interactions on the excitation spectrum of these molecules. So this is a different group of folks And Joe Whalen did a lot of his work before he graduated and went to work at the Naval Observatory. And also I have to really thank our theory collaborators who have helped us to think about these systems. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. I mean, amazing results and very nice talk. I have a question to the first part, the SSH model. What you described is essentially a single particle physics version. How about the perspective to go to a many-body problem? Like, do you have anything? I mean, you didn't comment on that much, so.
Yeah.
Is there a pathway to like convert this into a many-body quantum simulator?
Yeah, I think so. And now, of course, there are some things you can do, some things you can't do. But the proposed scheme is to use optical tweezers. You want to have particles, but it's important those particles don't run into each other because Rydberg interactions could cause you troubles there. So the scheme is to have an array of Rydberg atoms. And a single atom per tweezer, and now and then you apply the microwaves, and the kind of systems that you can create. This is physics that's been explored by Caden Hazard and some others, is lead to things like you would take advantage of interactions like this, where for example you'd get a coupling and an entanglement that's strongest between localized sites, for example, and it leads to phenomenon like binding. If I just had two particles here, you can imagine I would form bound states, and the system would want to tunnel together. So that gives you a sense of the kind of physics you would look at. And as you go to many, many more sites, you could imagine strings in one dimension that might want to tunnel together, or membranes. That's the kind of physics you could imagine to look at. Now, of course, that realizes some interesting things, but doesn't realize what would happen if you had tunneling together in real space. Like, you're not going to have Fermi statistics or Bonnet-Posonic statistics, so you don't have that aspect of the many-body system. But at least in terms of complexity and richness of the physics, that's the scheme to go towards many-body systems.
And experimentally, it means you have to have local microwave control, or like local.
No. You would apply your microwaves globally, so that each particle really moves in the same synthetic space. Mm-hmm. But what's localized is the interactions, because it will fall off as particles are separated. So it's not so while they're all moving in the same synthetic space, there is some memory of the fact that there is a real space in that interactions are not the same for all particles moving in the synthetic space.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Tom. So I have a question about this. So you mentioned about the keeping track of all the different AC Stark shifts.
Yep.
But in some of my head, I think about all these microwave fields interfering with each other and the atom then interacting with that as the dressing field.
Mm-hmm.
But in that situation, then this kind of interfering dressing field is different if you pick, say, those four ends, or you pick like n equals 50 to 53. So mm-hmm. Do you need to do this for different bunches of sets of states to extract something? So to me, there's something about the interfering microwave field that I can't take out from this in some ways.
Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't thought about it from that. I tend to think about it from the individual components, but I think you would get the same picture. You would have oscillating fields. If you think of adding all the fields together, it has some very complex frequency dependence through all the interference, and that gives you all these couplings that couple all the different states. So it has all the frequency components in there. But certainly, you do as you change the quantum number, everything changes in a sense. And certainly the AC Stark shifts, you have to take into account how this level is shifted by applying fields that might be resonant with all the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
It's the component of this coupling, how that shifts this level.
Yeah.
That's you have to keep track. And it grows with the number of levels.
Yeah, I see. Thanks.
We have an online question. Okay. Oh, okay. I was told that the participants should be able to unmute and ask their own questions. Okay.
I just had a technical question. I just missed how you set the length of the chain and you pick the non-trivial configuration rather trivial. So is your microwave a polychromatic microwave?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, sorry, I went through that very quickly. Because your resolution is so good with the millimeter waves, there's a slight difference in the resonance frequency between all these levels. So you choose, by the frequency of the millimeter waves you apply, you have coupling, you can isolate, say, I'm going to couple these levels by putting on the frequency resonant with these levels.
I see.
So you choose that by the frequencies you apply.
And the reason you're not coupled to D state is just selection rules with polarization?
Frequency. You know, the D states are shifted enough by the S states that if I want to couple to a D state, I have to apply a different frequency.
I see, great. And in terms of advantages of neutral atoms or alkaline earth atom versus trapped ions, is the fact that you can do in 2D and they're effectively the Rydberg state is trapped. Is that what you had in mind?
Well, I have to think about specifically what aspect of the ion you're envisioning incorporating, whether you're thinking about Rydberg atoms in the ion system or not. I think doing this on Rydberg states in an ion trap could be fine. I think it could be fine.
Like the work of Jens Spillmann with synthetic gauge fields.
So I think that in principle you could add synthetic gauge fields by controlling the phases of these millimeter waves. Compared to the ground state type work from Ian Spillmann, in principle you have more levels in Rydberg systems, and this interaction localized in synthetic space, it's hard to get a localized interaction in synthetic space. That's one thing that I think is difficult in the ground state, hyperfine state type realizations of synthetic dimensions.
Okay. So, can I ask a question?